Warning, Kind of Murdery contains adult themes, explicit language, and descriptions of violence. It is not suitable for anyone, and we recommend you stop listening now.
True crime with a dash of the paranormal, the garish, the strange, and the darkly comic. I'm Zevin Odelberg, and you've found your way to Kind of Murdery, a place that means more than just murder. It's my very own pocket dimension, home to a curated collection of bizarre and compelling stories, the unsolved, the unsettling, and the unbelievable. I cover it all, just so long as it's Kind of Murdery. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Kind of Murdery. I'm your host, Zevin Odelberg. Thank you for choosing to spend your valuable time with me. Okay, I'm pretty excited, guys, because today is the first episode of a theme series I'm doing here on Kinda Murdery. It's my first theme series, so yeah, I'm geeked about it. For the rest of the month of August, I'm going to be telling true crime stories about murderers who are romantically involved with other murderers. In my reel, I referred to the theme as a Romeo and Murderette, and while that name is tongue-in-cheek, it's nevertheless instructive. But Romeo and Murderette is not what I'm calling the rest of this month's theme. No, the official title is Killer Couples. And today's episode is our first killer couple. It's called Natural Born Lovers, a riff on the 1994 Oliver Stone classic Natural Born Killers starring Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis. Today's notorious Natural Born Lovers are the murdering, bank and train robbing duo of Dale Jones and Margie Dean. Jones and Dean, which sounds vaguely like a 1950s musical duo. Well, you see, Dale and Margie, Jones and Dean, were terrifying the American Southwest in the 19-teens, about 14 or 15 years before their more famous paramour counterparts, Bonnie and Clyde. Indeed, while Dale and Margie's exploits were fascinating and horrifying the nation, Bonnie and Clyde were in the second grade. But Dale and Margie were every bit as notorious as Bonnie and Clyde in their day, and while it may be morally questionable to root for the fame of murdering bandits, I'm going to go ahead and say that Dale Jones and Margie Dean deserve to be every bit as famous as Bonnie and Clyde. Their exploits may, in fact, be even more epic, and I suspect that Bonnie and Clyde's greater fame is more the result of the widespread adoption of radios in the home by the mid-1930s, and has nothing to do with their exploits being more legendary, because they weren't. I promise you that Dale and Margie can match Bonnie and Clyde punch for punch, robbery for robbery, crack shot for crack shot, and wild-eyed daring for wild-eyed daring. But you don't have to take my word for it. Killer couple number one, natural born lovers Dale Jones and Margie Dean, starts now. Hey, buddy, wait a minute. Patrolman William F. Coger of Kansas City, Missouri, called to a harmless-looking youngster whom he discovered loitering about the railroad yards. But the policeman passed on to eternity before those 60 seconds in the minute that he'd asked for had elapsed. Shot through the heart by the 14-year-old slayer, Dale Jones, Kansas City's boy bandit, had started on his career of blood. Escaping from the police dragnet, the precocious young criminal robbed and fought his way across a continent, lone-handed for 4 long years. "Dale Jones is my man," dramatically announced Mattie Howard, queen of Kansas City's underworld, standing on top of a table in a crowded cabaret with a significant gesture to the gun in her belt. Mattie hurled warning to the youth's jealous rivals for her affections. Henceforth, he was to be her chosen partner, in crime and in love. Shortly afterward, Dale began to make weekly trips to St. Louis to visit the notorious Lewis brothers. Those desperate bandits attracted him, as did their sister, the beautiful Eva Lewis, singer in a cabaret, to whom he made clandestine love. Fugitives from justice, a price upon their heads for the killing of several police officers, the assassin bandits slipped through every net spread for them by the police. Despite the repeated warnings of Dale Jones to the gang to keep undercover, Frank Lewis took a chance and drove to a newsstand at 12th and Charlotte Street to buy a newspaper. Detective Harry Arthur, who was passing, instantly recognized him. There was a tense moment. Then, "I think the chief wants to see you," the detective announced quietly. "Hell he does," sneered Lewis. He already had spotted the officer and was sitting in the car with his hat in his hand, and his gun, under the hat. Lewis pointed the gun at the detective's head and pulled the trigger. The gun snapped. Arthur threw up his arm just as Lewis pulled the trigger the second time, striking the gun hand of the man in the car upward, causing the bullet to go wild. Lewis struck Arthur in the mouth with his fist, and at the same time let the car in gear. The machine shot forward, hurling the officer to the pavement. Leaping up, Arthur commandeered a passing automobile and pursued the speeding car of the man who had tried to murder him, but Lewis was finally swallowed up in the traffic. The officer returned to the scene of the encounter to retrieve his hat, which was still lying in the street with a bullet hole through the crown. A few days later, after the experience at 12th and Charlotte, Frank Lewis got word that his brothers, Ora and Roy, had passed through Wichita and had shot a grocery man during a robbery. The grocery store proprietor, Matt Tambling, was held up by Ora and Roy Lewis when the brothers returned to Wichita while en route to Kansas City. The St. Louis murderers had been dogged by the law from one end of the country to the other, and had even been followed to the Mexican border and foiled in an attempt to cross. Mr. Tambling, who refused to stand as ordered and submit to being robbed by the Lewis brothers, was shot through the nose, but survived the wound. The Wichita police, however, at first believed him to have been killed, and another murder was promptly chalked up against the St. Louis brothers. It's interesting, I've never heard Ora as a man's name. Perhaps short for Orville, who knows? Anyhow, Ora and Roy Lewis escaped from the Wichita police the second time and arrived in Kansas City 2 days later. They are said to have walked the entire distance. Believing Frank to be in Kansas City, Ora and Roy began making the rounds of the speakeasies and dives in search of their older brother. They searched for several days, but in vain, for Frank Lewis, ignorant of the fact that his brothers had returned to Kansas City and were desperately in need of assistance, remained as far away from Kansas City as possible. He did not care for another encounter such as the one he had had with Detective Arthur. Roy Lewis, the youngest of the three brothers, grew lonesome to see his sister. So, leaving Ora in Kansas City, he returned home to St. Louis. He was captured within an hour of arriving there. He was charged with murder and the date of his trial set for a week later. His attorneys, however, succeeded in getting the case continued on the plea of new evidence intended to establish Roy's innocence of any actual participation in the two murders. Full credit for the capture of Roy Lewis and the final clearing up of the brutal slayings of police officers McKenna and Dillon by Ora and Roy Lewis was given to patrolman Bernard J. Hegeman. It was Hegeman who watched the Lewis home constantly all during the weeks that Roy and Ora were being hunted. He stuck by the belief that a criminal always returns in time to the scene of his crime. At last, his spirit broken from the long, grueling chase he had led the police on in half the larger cities of the United States, Ora Lewis gave up the search for Frank. He went to a cheap rooming house at 812 East 14th Street, Kansas City, and rented a room. Detective Arthur, patrolling that section of the city in a police car, saw Ora enter the house, so, with Detective John P. Clifford, who was working with him, Arthur followed his man into the rooming house and asked the landlady to show him to the room of the young man who had just come in. Ora had been given a room on the first floor, and hearing voices in the hall, peered out to get a glimpse of the newcomers. He recognized the two men standing halfway inside the door as officers. Opening the doors of his room cautiously, the murderer tiptoed toward the rear door. But Arthur, expecting this, had not failed to note the slight movement in the room down the hall. Ora had taken but a few steps when Detective Arthur turned to his partner and shouted to him, "Stop that man! He is a brother of the man who shot my hat off!" Shoving the landlady aside, both officers sprang forward and started running after the fleeing man. For some reason, I pictured like a Monty Python style, they shoved the lady out of the way completely unnecessarily before running after the fleeing man, but I'm sure that's not what happened. Shoving the landlady aside, both officers sprang forward and started running after the fleeing man. Ora was overtaken just as he reached the door, and in less than 24 hours, the Kansas City police were releasing the prisoner to the St. Louis authorities, to whom Ora made a full confession, not omitting the gruesome details of the slaughter of Officer Dillon. The cases of Ora and Roy Lewis were tried together in Circuit Judge Grimm's court at St. Louis on November 25, 1916. Roy was given life imprisonment, and Ora Lewis was sentenced to hang. Ora's case was appealed to the Supreme Court, and on February 16, 1918, the sentence of death was confirmed by that tribunal. Date of execution was set for April 5, 1918. In the meantime, following the death penalty imposed on Ora Lewis, in a cabaret off of Olive Street, amid the din of a jazz band and shuffling of feet and shadow-like waiters hurrying with trays of drinks. Another scene that apparently has no place in the drama of the circuit court verdict is being enacted. Everything is just as it's always been in the wild nightlife of the Olive Street cabaret, when suddenly, the music stops and the dancers walk to their tables. The spotlight is turned on the tiny stage. A girl rises, one of the singers that line the wall back of the piano player. The crowd at the tables prepares for a burst of ragtime. "I wonder," the girl says in a low, rich voice, "I wonder if any of you know what it means to have a brother hanged." The girl is Eva Lewis, who, during the months in which her brother Ora was being hunted that he might be hanged, was temporarily forgotten and left to her thoughts of what would happen when the law found Ora Lewis. Ora Lewis, the murderer. Can you picture what it would be to have your brother mount the gallows with the executioner beside him? To have the black cap pulled over his eyes, to have the noose adjusted about his neck, to be asked if he had any last words to give the world, to hear the intoning of a prayer for his soul, then to have the trap sprung, and your brother shot downward, earthward, until the cruel hemp draws tight with a snap and breaks his neck. Can you picture your brother hanging there limp and lifeless, his laughing eyes glazed and his gay voice forever stilled? "My brother will hang!" The girl cries, screams, almost startling diners out of their chairs. A death-like hush falls over the vast hall that a moment before was filled with the noise of the merrymakers. Unless you will help me to save his life!" The pretty dancer shouts in a final burst of tragic, frenzied agony. Then Eva Lewis, in the sweet, gentle tones of a woman of culture, tells in a heart-to-heart talk of her seemingly hopeless battle with the courts to save her brother's life. The talk takes 3 minutes of her stage time, after which she circulates a petition through the audience, a petition to Governor Gardner of Missouri, asking commutation of the death sentence. If there are 500 persons in the audience, Eva Lewis returns to the tiny stage with 500 names added to the list of people who, by having signed the petition, are opposing Judge Grimm's sentence on Ora Lewis. Such a scene might have been viewed by anyone attending the Olive Street Cabaret at St. Louis back in the latter part of 1916 and the early part of 1917. Whether or not the petition submitted to Governor Gardner early in 1917 had any influence on the chief executive of Missouri was never known. But Ora Lewis's death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. Even after the death penalty in Missouri was repealed in 1918, and after the Supreme Court of Missouri had ruled that Ora Lewis should hang in spite of the abolition on capital punishment, so he should hang even though Missouri no longer had capital punishment. That is how terrible the Missouri Supreme Court thought he was. And after all of that, the governor still commuted his sentence, and so we leave Ora and Roy Lewis in the Missouri State Penitentiary, surrounded by high, gray prison walls, behind which they are to spend the rest of their lives. Neither of them may even hope for a parole because, as Ora, the last of the pair to be captured, has often told J.H. Livingston, superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Identification at the Jefferson City Prison, "No respectable governor would have the audacity to give the Lewis brothers a pardon." We return to the Jones-Lewis Bandit Gang and the nervous members of the crew whose demeanors have now grown to wolf-like expressions of hatred, mingled with something that might, to a person unacquainted with the underworld type of man, be mistaken for fear. But it was not fear. No member of Dale Jones' pack ever experienced the sensation of fear. Speaking of Dale Jones, he's the Romeo in this Romeo and Murderette story that we're telling today. And it seems that with the brothers in prison, he's now the de facto leader of the Jones-Lewis gang. I mean, after all, it is his last name in the title there. But nevertheless, just drawing your attention to this key character. So no member of Dale Jones' pack ever experienced the sensation of fear. Even Blackie Lancaster, who had been a coward all his life, was made unafraid by his association with young Dale Jones. Every man of them, Oudelet, Cheryl, Thomas Knight, and Frank Lewis, was suffering from a bad case of the fidgets. Dale, too, was getting impatient. The gang wanted work to do, dangerous work, preferably work that involved death itself. And Dale Jones furnished it. The Industrial State Bank at Argentine was robbed. The Sugar Creek Bank was held up. The Southside State Bank was looted twice within a few weeks. The first robbery of the Southside Bank was staged by Maddie Howard and her gang, and James Sanger, Maddie's lover, was killed. The Jones-Lewis Bandit Gang swung into action. Robbery after robbery was committed, and not a break was made in any of them. It was such a simple matter, this bank piracy. Just saunter into the bank that had been chosen as the next place to be honored by a visit from the gang, one man at a time. The first man would walk boldly up to the teller's window, tender a large bill, and ask the bank employee to break the note into small change. A second man would do likewise, then a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. It usually took 20 minutes for all the robbers to get into the bank, following one another at intervals of about 4 or 5 minutes. Each man would call for a change at a different window if the bank happened to be large enough to employ more than 2 or 3 tellers. The entire gang was now inside the bank, having entered as any persons might enter, without attracting attention or suspicion in the least. Each bandit standing in a different part of the building, counting the change from his banknotes. Suddenly, Dale Jones, who also worked the same ruse of getting a bill changed, would drop a coin on the floor. 5 handfuls of silver would ring on the surface of the bank floor as one, the metallic sound echoing through the offices in which a score, or more maybe, of men and women toiled over voluminous books, noisy electric adding machines, and clicking typewriters. It never failed, this idea introduced by Dale Jones and executed only by Dale Jones. All the employees of the institution that was now receiving a visit from the Jones-Lewis Bandit Pack would drop the tasks they were engaged in, and their minds, ever ready to be diverted from the routine of counting money or recording words, words in soothing tone but sinister in meaning. "Well, I guess you folks are the losers in this game," said Dale. All right, we're back. Thank you for giving our sponsors a moment of your time. Before we jump back into the story, I wanted to send a shout out to Kathy Hoffman from Newburgh, Oregon, who sent me an email and took me up on my offer to send out super rad, full-color vinyl Kinda Murdery stickers. All you have to do is ask. Thank you, Kathy, for asking. Thank you for listening, and thank you for wanting one of my Kinda Murdery stickers. I'm sending you several. So listen, everyone, if you want a Kinda Murdery sticker, email kindamurdery@gmail.com, shoot me your address, and I'll send you one, too. Kathy will always have a special place in my heart for requesting my first sticker, but there's plenty of room on the bandwagon. So again, email me at kindamurdery@gmail.com, and I'll send you a sticker. If you want to see what they look like, check out @kindamurdery on Instagram. All right, let's get back into the story. As always, I'm going to rewind it a little bit to drop us back into the narrative, but I'm ready. I hope you're ready. Let's rock and roll. All the employees of the institution that was now receiving a visit from the Jones-Lewis Bandit Pack would drop the tasks they were engaged in, and their minds, ever ready to be diverted from the routine of counting money or recording words, words in soothing tone but sinister in meaning. "Well, I guess you folks are the losers in this game," said Dale. Having become masters of the situation in the bank, each member of the gang would do the thing he was supposed to do. 2 men would stand in the doorway, one on either side of the entrance, their guns concealed, letting all newcomers in, but preventing their leaving. Each person entering the bank would be prodded gently in the small of the back by one of the doormen and ordered in a quiet voice to step aside and stand with their face to the wall, but without raising their hand. It always worked. "Just stand over there, please, and act as natural as possible," the bandits would order in tones that sounded like a request, but were nevertheless orders. A man's voice was a valuable asset in the opinion of Jones and Lewis. Oudelet and Cheryl usually acted as doormen. But when Kansas City Blackie joined the gang, he was posted at the door with Cheryl, and Oudelet worked the tills. This arrangement was made because of Blackie's shooting ability. One man was stationed at each end of the bank room, sweeping the length and breadth of the building with his gun. The two remaining members of the band would loot the vault and money tills. Dale himself worked the vault. The entire job was performed in less than 1/10 of the time it required to tell it. Many a person caught in a bank that was being robbed by the Jones gang has marveled at the smoothness and rapidity with which the bandits worked. Few people were ever foolish enough to make a false move in the presence of the most notorious robber organization that America has ever known. The bandits had cleaned up Kansas City. The Sugar Creek Bank, the Industrial State Bank, and the Southside Bank had yielded a good profit. There was never a hitch in any of the jobs, all of them having been pulled according to the foregoing plan. Best of all, there hadn't been a casualty. It was one of the unpardonable sins of the Jones-Lewis gang to shoot where shooting was not absolutely necessary. Dale Jones knew what it meant to be tried for murder, and Frank Lewis had learned a great deal from the court trials of his two brothers. The Kansas City police were concentrating every ounce of that great law enforcement organization's strength on the capture of the gang that was terrorizing the city and outlying districts. When a score of additional men were signed up to patrol the city in one big campaign, Jones, still a very young man and the most sought-after criminal in the entire Southwest, called a conference of his gang. The Council of War was held 50 miles from Kansas City, under the protection of the rolling Missouri hills, where the gang had set up its permanent hideout. The conference ended in hurried preparations to move on according to the original plans laid by Jones and Lewis. To see America first, along the sights of pistols and high-powered rifles. Indianapolis, Indiana was the first stopover. When the gang left the city, its members were $18,000 richer, which, by the way, is $353,000 today, so no chump change, for which they had a small national bank to thank. A wide swing and several days of traveling took the notorious party of, quote, tourists, unquote, to Los Angeles. Here the gang scattered, each taking his share of the spoils from the dozen robberies. The men were ordered to report to Dale Jones within 10 days to lay plans for a job that he, Dale, would have spotted by that time. While resting in Los Angeles before the scheduled meeting of the gang was to take place, Jones renewed old acquaintances in the city. Among them was Margie Dean, and here we meet our murderette, an Italian woman several years Dale's senior, whom he had met in Los Angeles during his residence there in the home of a wealthy California real estate man who had befriended him as a boy. Margie and Dale went to Tijuana, and in the Mexican sporting city between horse races and poker games, Margie Dean proved to Dale Jones why she should travel with him as an active member of the gang he headed. The girl could shoot, and she had nerve. She demonstrated the latter by holding up a party of American sportsmen in broad daylight and robbing them of several $100s and their watches. She clipped the heads from Mexican quail to prove she was a crack pistol shot. And besides, Margie Dean was very much in love with young Jones, so down in Tijuana, over their whiskey glasses, or maybe tequila glasses, not that American newspaper writers knew what tequila was in 1928, but sure, maybe it was bourbon. Over their whiskey glasses, Dale Jones and Margie Dean were married by common law. The gang assembled again in Los Angeles on December 7, 1917, and talked over plans for their next robbery. The following day, six men trooped into the bank at Culver City, a residential suburb of Los Angeles. A tall, olive-complexioned woman sat in a car park at the curb directly in front of the little bank. Her left hand rested on the steering wheel. In her right, which lay on the front seat of the machine, covered with a silk scarf, was a .38 caliber revolver. 15 minutes had elapsed since the first of the sextet walked briskly through the arched doorway of the bank. The girl in the car was becoming nervous. She looked up and down the quiet street, then back through the big windows of the bank, and saw Dale Jones, the bandit leader, drop the coin which gave the signal. The girl's right hand trembled under the scarf, shaking the silken material like a light gust of wind. Her right foot poised over the gasoline accelerator tensed, and her left foot, trembling, instinctively began to draw upward, slowly, gradually letting the car in gear. Her eyes again swept the paved residential street in each direction and roved back to the wide glass windows through which four men could be seen moving about with a swiftness and precision that resembled the working of a well-oiled machine. One of the bandits who stood in the doorway was concealed behind a stone pillar that stood just inside the entrance, but the other, Blackie Lancaster, was in plain view from the street. He was lounging against another pillar, standing opposite that which hid Cheryl. Apparently a disinterested spectator of the scene that was being enacted behind the cages, but in his left hand was a gun, and the thumb toyed the hammer of the old single-action 45 nervously, letting the firing pin down to within a thousandth of an inch of the cap of the cartridge and raising the hammer again to the point where it was ready to click and turn the cylinder on a new chamber. With a cat-like movement, Dale Jones turned from the bank vault where it had taken him only a few seconds to scoop up $8,000 in currency, leapt onto the counting table through the small window of the teller's cage, and jumped lightly to the floor. Frank Lewis, Oudelet, and Knight quickly followed their chief, and all four bandits who had been working behind the cages walked rapidly through the door and headed for the car in which the girl sat. They reached the curb, and Dale stooped to climb into the seat next to Margie Dean. This was the signal for Blackie and Cheryl. The doormen, brandishing their guns, started running backwards out of the bank, keeping the bank employees covered. Their retreat, in turn, was being covered by the four men in the car. Blackie and Cheryl reached the automobile, both diving headfirst into the rear seat and into the arms of their confederates. The car shot forward in low gear. Then the girl driver shifted gears to second and roared around a corner into a street that stretched out straight ahead for miles. Again she shifted gears, let out the clutch, and pressed the accelerator level to the floorboards. Margie Dean had been initiated into the Jones-Lewis bandit gang. She had been given her cue how to act down there in Tijuana, and she had learned it well. The big car roared out of Culver City at 70 miles an hour with Margie Dean at the wheel. Beside her sat young Dale Jones, his blonde hair flying in the wind. Jones never wore a hat while robbing a bank. On the two jump seats of the seven-passenger Marmon automobile sat Blackie Lancaster and Cheryl, and behind these two, all three kneeling in the rear seat, watching the miles recede through the rear curtain glass, were Frank Lewis, Oudelet, and Thomas Knight. The robbery of the Culver City Bank occurred early in the afternoon. That night found the seven bandits in Arcadia, one of the most beautiful of the many small California towns which dot that picturesque state. Dale Jones promised himself that someday he would return here to make it his home. After several days of driving, mostly by night to avoid contact with tourists and residents of the many towns and cities through which they passed, the bandits reached Kansas City. They planned to go into hiding in or near Kansas City until they felt safe in sallying forth again on their unfinished mission. Upon their arrival in the Missouri City, Frank Lewis got word to his sister Eva, who was still singing and dancing in a St. Louis cabaret, and had her meet him. There was much for the brother and sister to talk about. First, Frank was eager to hear of his young wife and the baby. Frank wondered if Eva couldn't arrange to have his wife come to him. His sister said she thought she could manage it, and arrangements were made for Eva to return to St. Louis and get Frank's wife and baby and take them to the gang's rendezvous in the hills. When Eva Lewis drove out to the hills in which her brother and his associates were hiding, she was prepared to stay. Unlike Margie Dean, who was willing to rough it with the men, Eva could not sacrifice all that was feminine and live a rough life led by the gang. In the half-carload of personal effects with which she had been accustomed to living, and which she took with her into the bandit camp, was a small camera. It was with this camera that Eva snapped the picture of Frank Lewis holding his 6-month-old baby. The snapshot was taken shortly after her arrival in camp with Frank's wife and child. Frank's wife remained in the robber camp for several days until Jones ordered the young mother and her baby to be returned to the city. It can be said of Frank Lewis that he was really in love with his young wife and cared deeply for the child she'd borne him. But Dale, neither a husband nor a father, cared not at all for Frank's feelings about seeing his wife and child and literally kicked them out of camp. So one morning, Frank Lewis drove out of camp in one of the two automobiles. The second car had been brought by Eva, and in the machine with him rode his wife and her infant child. Frank drove to within a few miles of Kansas City, and coming to an intersection of two roads, one of which was a regular bus route, he let the young mother out of the car and bade her farewell. Heading the car again back toward the bandit camp, Frank looked back over his shoulder for a last glimpse of the girl whose life was to be forever darkened because of her love for a crook. A few months later, she was automatically divorced from Frank Lewis, and she returned to her people in the suburbs of St. Louis. That's mildly mysterious. I'd like to know what's going to happen. Dale kept his gang in camp for several weeks, sending first one and then another of the men to the city for provisions and to obtain information of what the police were doing. During these weeks in which the six men and the two women were constantly thrown together with one another, seeing no one but themselves, a situation that had not been foreseen by Jones when he permitted the women to travel with the gang had developed and was growing more acute each day. Dale Jones really was young if he didn't foresee that two young women in camp with a gaggle of hardened bandits might create drama. But anyhow, three of the men were now madly in love with Eva Lewis, who now had asserted herself and insisted on being called, quote, queen of the gang. Worse still, the two women were fighting between themselves over Jones. Again, Dale must have been young not to have seen all of this coming. Perhaps not the proclamation of the queen of the gang, but several of the men falling in love with the two women and then the two women fighting is pretty much a guarantee to anyone with a little bit of life experience. So anyway, worse still, the two women were fighting between themselves over Jones. Marjorie Dean and Eva are known to have gotten into a genuine hair-pulling cat fight when each of them contested the other's claim to, quote, first place in the bandit leader's heart. Frank Lewis never figured in the arguments that took place over which one of his sister's three suitors should claim the girl as his, quote, woman. Dale had only to look at Lewis, and the one-time terror of St. Louis would cower before the stronger will of the cold-blooded robber chief. So Dale had complete control over Frank Lewis, and in fact, he also had that level of control over Oudelet and Cheryl. But now, Oudelet and Cheryl are rivals for Eva's affection, and so when the cabaret singer joined the gang, with her fresh young beauty and her great mass of rich auburn hair and coquettish eyes, which lost none of their charm because of her forethought in bringing to the camp a plentiful supply of cosmetics, all of these charms threatened to be the cause of the entire breaking up of the most perfectly organized band of robbers the country has ever known. So basically what the writer's saying is that Eva Lewis is Yoko Ono about to break up the Beatles. For 3 days, neither Jones nor Cheryl nor Oudelet dared close an eye in sleep or turn their backs to one another for fear of being shot. So fierce were the fires of hatred that flamed in their souls. Dale Jones had complete control over the best bank-robbing bandit gang in United States history, and then his new common-law wife, Margie Dean, and more to the point, Eva Lewis, the gorgeous cabaret younger sister of Dale's partner, Frank, shows up in camp, and suddenly Dale is afraid to go to sleep because either Oudelet or Cheryl might kill him or each other. That's how much and how quickly morale had deteriorated. Geez, maybe he should have let Frank Lewis keep his wife and child in the camp. That might have had a mitigating effect, but hindsight's 20/20. So they dared not close an eye or turn their backs to each other for fear of being shot. So fierce were the fires of hatred that flamed in their souls. And each day, Jones expected his subjects in crime to turn on him, with all the hatred and ferocity with which a wolf pack attacks its leader. We're going to pause our story there. Be sure to tune in this Sunday, August 14th, for part 2 of Killer Couples, Natural Born Lovers, Dale Jones and Margie Dean. That's right. Be back here on Sunday as the story of two of America's most felonious bandit lovers continues. I'm Zevin Odelberg, and this has been Kinda Murdery. If you've enjoyed today's Kinda Murdery, please tell your friends and family. tell strangers, leave a review. It's the best way to ensure that I can keep telling that special brand of bizarre and terrible tales that you'll only find here on Kinda Murdery.